Welcome to the Kindling's Muse podcast, an intelligent, imaginative, hospitable exploration of ideas that matter in contemporary life. And now, here's your host, Dick Staub.
Well, welcome everybody. This is Dick Staub, and I have to be honest, tonight is the first time it has ever occurred to me how presumptuous it is to introduce an intelligent show, and then now your host, Dick Staub. In all the years, you know, the whole concept for this show was born out of the inklings. I was in Oxford, and I heard Anthony Flew, the world's leading atheist, who had declared that he had become a theist. And he was asked if he'd ever met C.S. Lewis. And he said, oh, I used to go as a student at Oxford and sit as close as I could at the Burden Baby just to overhear the conversation of the inklings, C.S. Lewis and J.R. Tolkien. And I called my friend Marty O'Donnell, who had been trying to get me to do a podcast, and I said, so what would you think if we did a show in a pub? I just had a roundtable discussion, except the difference is it would be us instead of C.S. Lewis and J.R. Tolkien. What a sobering thought right there. But then the other difference would be that the audience could actually get in on the conversation. And that's how this show was born. I came back and talked to Mike Hale. And so we came up with intelligent and imaginative, and then my friend Martin Marty said we need to add the word hospitable, because he said every religious tradition has a tradition of hospitality. If we remembered that, there'd be less tension between Muslims, Jews, and Christians. So we threw in hospitable, and that's how that whole phrase came about. And tonight's the first time I ever realized that we don't actually do any of those things on this show.
So
it's kind of embarrassing, so we're just going to end now before we go any further. Well, tonight we're doing a show that we've been doing every year for the last few years. I love this show, but it is a show that has to move quickly and is bound to frustrate because we used to do the theology of the Academy Award nominees back when there were only five nominees. Now there are 10, and we used to have a hard time getting through five, but we're going to do our very best tonight. We're going to be looking at themes in these films. And in the broadest sense, theologically, you know, the story of creation, the story of the fallenness of humans, the human condition, stories of hope, and is there a redemption of human life and existence? Is there purpose? Is there meaning? And our panel is Jeff Overstreet. He's a film critic. He's an author. His newest book, you have got a little card on your... Did this just come out?
Yeah.
This little card is on your tables, except if you're listening by podcast, you probably don't have one on your table. Jeffrey Overstreet, The Ale Boys Feast, and let's have a big round of applause for Jeff. And Jenny Spohr is the producer of The Kindling's Muse, and Dr. Christine Cheney is the associate professor of English. We try to bring a doctor in every time because we want to make sure there's actually a physician. Oh, you're not that good. No.
Take two poems and call me in the morning.
That's right. Associate Professor of English, Chair of the English Department at Seattle Pacific University. And let's have a big round of applause. So without any further introduction, let's get right into it. And in order to eliminate the amount of time it takes to describe each of these films, we're simply going to read the briefest of description, which is from IMDb. Which gives you the briefest description of the film. And for True Grit, here's what they say. Actually, this is going to be laughable. A tough U.S. Marshal helps a stubborn young woman track down her father's murderer. That pretty much captures it, doesn't it, Jeff?
Jeff.
So take it away. True Grit. Tell us about it.
Well, Hailee Steinfeld is 13 years old, this actress who plays Maddie Ross and who just steals the show. Why she's nominated for Best Supporting Actress... I have no idea. She's clearly the lead character in the film. It's more lines than anybody. Talks a mile a minute.
And she had never acted before.
Right.
Yeah.
Except in like a commercial, but
yeah.
We won't talk about that. And she's sort of an ancestor, I think, to Marge Gunderson, the lead character in the Coen Brothers Fargo, because she's
that's a sobering thought right there.
Strong female character out for justice, you know? And she, and yet... More than any Coen Brothers movie since Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, she's willing to bring some theological dialogue right into the script. I mean, she's confident that Providence is with her. She says, the author of all things watches over me. And I have a good horse.
Great line.
She says, no doubt Cheney, the killer, fancied himself scot-free, but he was wrong. You must pay for everything in this life, one way and another. There is nothing free except the grace of God. But she's
that's the only line that appears in the book and both True Grit movies.
Yeah, yeah. But she's out for justice, which is interesting. You'd think, you know, with that kind of belief in providence, maybe she would consider grace. She doesn't look very open to that. But by the end of the film, you have to admit that the search for justice has cost her dearly. And the lingering image, at least for me, the lingering scene, is actually an act of grace when this hard-hearted killer, he hunts down criminals, but he's killed a lot of men in his time. He seems to have finally adopted a daughter in a way, and he carries Maddie in this heroic scene, and that act of grace is what stayed on my mind for several days after that film. It's also very rare to see something like that in a Coen Brothers film. They tend to dwell on the wages of sin and the folly of the search for vengeance. This time they actually had some really moving
scenes.
Well,
and the music, Leaning on the Everlasting Arms.
Leaning on the Everlasting Arms.
Starts the beginning, runs through the whole thing.
Yeah.
She's running, he's carrying her in his arms. So
that, yeah. I mean, and if you know the end of the movie, there's an ironic twist to the use of that hymn as well, but we won't want to spoil everything for everybody. But yeah.
Oh, why not? What do you guys want to add to True Grit?
I think that was absolutely an amazing image, too. And the idea that it's what taught the Jeff Bridges character that he said, I'm getting too old for this. I mean, it's the one that tells him it's time to move on.
Yeah.
But that he sort of expends every last bit of that vigilante, mercenary character in that act of love.
Nothing.
Nothing.
You got nothing.
Well, I just know we're moving fast. It makes
we're moving
honest.
Fast. Yeah. We'll keep going, and people can ask questions. The King's Speech. Jenny. Wow.
That's the Colin Firth fans in the crowd, right?
No.
Right.
The King's Speech, another Coen Brothers movie.
Colin Firth can do no wrong.
A masterpiece theater movie.
Are you going to read my two?
Oh, yeah,
second
I'm sorry.
King's Speech.
Sorry, I'm already forgetting what my job is here. The story of King George VI of Britain, his impromptu accession to the throne, and the speech therapist who helped the unsure monarch become worthy of it.
Yeah. This movie, just as far as film craft, was just a delight to see. And as somebody who looks at this a lot, I just thought it was impeccably well done and put together. Just everything from the shooting, it looked like paintings. I mean, each shot was almost like a painting, to the music. I kind of fell in love with this movie, so I'm a little biased. But ultimately, what I felt like this movie was about, and I think all of the movies, almost all the movies this go around are kind of these buddy movies, if you will, strange buddy movies. But it seemed this one in particular was about breaking down the wall of society's constructs. So the walls that society puts on us, the labels society puts on us, and the labels we put on ourselves. And it breaks those down and opens us up to a true community experience, a true love with another human being. And in the end, in finding our full humanity through that, through the breakdown, we can bear up underneath all of these constructs and triumph. So examples of this in the movie, he wasn't supposed to be king. His brother was, but his brother had an interesting affair with a Nazi sympathizer, so he abdicated the throne. And there's this great scene where George VI is with his wife, played brilliantly by Helena Bonham Carter,
amazing.
And he just is shaking, and he says, I'm not a king, I'm not a king. And you're seeing, here is this guy who kingship has been thrust upon him in the beginnings of World War II, and he's not who everyone says he's supposed to be. And then again, you have Jeffrey Rush, who's this doctor who's going to help him stop stuttering. He finds out, the king finds out that Jeffrey Rush's character, Dr. Logue, is not a doctor at all. He's just self-studied. And yet, this is the man who can cure, you can't cure stuttering, but has helped him be able to make a speech to the nation without stuttering. So it's unlike some of those common, some of the common myth and some of the common movies that we see that are about pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. You know, we're the rugged individualist. You do it on your own and you triumph. This movie is saying, no, it's about those who come alongside you and walk with you in this life, helping you to find your own voice. Colin Firth screams at the coronation chair when his jester is sitting in it. Jeffrey Rush is sitting in the coronation chair, which is a no-no. If you know anything about it, he says, I have a voice. And that's what it's about, finding your voice. But he can only find voice through community and through love and true relationship.
With also with his wife, Helena Bonham Carter, besides being amazing, is their actual love and partnership and marriage, it's the other side of mm-hmm. that, those relationships. Without her just sort of, quietly, busily, Englishly coming alongside and, handing a sweet to the little
is
kids
that
in the waiting room.
Englishly, is that an actual phrase?
I just made that up. But
I know, but you're the head of a department.
Means she can't make
it. Are you like not really a doctor either?
No. When you're the head, you can make up words.
Well, that's good.
Stephen Colbert said truthiness. It's in the dictionary.
That's
now,
right. So she can say you that. Watch Englishly. It's going to be there soon.
So what do you think about The King's Speech? Because I don't think it's like a favorite of a lot of people for the best picture. Yeah. Yeah. And I don't think it's any of your top pick for the best picture.
I think it'll win, but it
is. Oh, it is Jenny's.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I like it. I think it's a very, very good 2 hours of Masterpiece Theater. And I say that as a big fan of Masterpiece Theater, seriously. But Colin Firth is great. I'll be happy if he wins. To me, it was, above all, a movie about the value of good teachers. I watched Lionel Logue, played by Jeffrey Rush, and I saw his patience. I saw his intuition about when to use force, his cleverness. He just showed love and grace and patience and was willing to take all kinds of crap from the king. So that was
that was
moving to me. But it was also moving to see someone who didn't want to be a leader, willing to sacrifice so much and humiliate himself, really, at least with the teacher, over and over again, in order to learn what it would take to carry the country through. There's been some debate about how historically accurate that is. So I take this just as an act of storytelling, and as an act of storytelling, it's a great tribute to teachers.
But the Queen saw it, and she liked it.
She did.
Yeah.
She did.
So there you go.
Yeah.
For
Moving
along.
Well, then.
Chris wants to combine Social Network with 127 Hours. And here's the description of 127 Hours.
Can you combine the summaries? That would be really interesting.
Actually,
well, we're hoping the founder of Facebook has a large rock fall on him, I think is what it's... 127 Hours is a mountain climber becomes trapped under a boulder while canyoneering. See, there's another Englishing.
That's
like canyoneering alone near Moab, Utah, and resorts to desperate measures in order to survive. True story. And The Social Network, a chronicle of the founding of Facebook, the social network and website.
Also a true story. One of my connections is the idea that we have the real world here. We're so much talking about either history or we're sort of trying to sort out, it seems like in films, what the world is today. The other theme mirroring from The King's Speech is this is all about American male self-determination. It's all about me, my technical skill. I'm an island. I'm a rock. Nobody touches me. Quite literally, both of them, and I found, the more I thought about it, that they were mirror images of each other. Both of them have these sort of glorying in my amazing technical skill as a American male. And yet, both, each of them, and of course, the arm cut off 127 hours, I think is the underappreciated masterpiece of this. Partly Danny Boyle. It's a really thought-provoking film, if only because, like Black Swan, the entire narrative is conducted almost completely by James Franco's face, in the way that the extreme close-ups on Natalie Portman, the whole story is told by the face, which is amazing, virtuosic, really, I think. But in the 127 hours, without giving away, he survives. is that he has to go through the process of faith, I really think, where you go through arrogance and total self-sufficiency, I don't need anybody, and he becomes smashed up against reality, and it humbles him, he's ragingly afraid, and he has to go through the process of disorientation, and then in a sense, grace. I mean, it's a miracle that he survives, right? And in the end, he chooses trust, humility, repentance, he's forgiven. Miraculously, he's given back his life. I mean, he was dead, in a sense. And the exact opposite goes on in Social Network, where you have the same choices around what do I do? What do I do in the moments and the moment when I have to choose, when my life has come smash up against this American ideology of it's all about power, and he chooses revenge and greed and total isolation. He rejects a kind of surrender that the Aaron Ralston has to sort of choose. He chooses instead anger, fear, wealth, and power. Mm-hmm. And what I think is what we have is that that's so much sort of the story of our time. And so I think both of them are fascinating, really interesting, really thought-provoking, but they kind of oddly go together for me.
So where Zuckerberg unfriends Eduardo, Aaron unfriends his arm. It's yes. very sad.
He doesn't unfriend Eduardo. He cuts him out of $500 million dollars by cheating
cuts
him.
Cuts him out. Another
yeah.
Per,
yeah.
Cuts him out. I think it's the last line of Social Network. She says this, one of the attorneys says to him, you know, Mark, you're not an asshole, but you're trying so hard to be one.
Yeah.
It's, you know, that's such.
Yeah. Except for I kind of.
Versus the in 120 hours, the opposite happens.
Yeah. You know? Oh, yeah. He goes from being an asshole to becoming to
yes,
somebody.
To finding love.
He really does. And his own son sort of, you know, comes to him.
He has a premonition about his son.
And after we have the crisis where he, you know, miraculously survives, he actually looks back and says, thank you. To something, to the universe.
And he also keeps saying please.
Please.
Throughout it, too.
Yeah.
Which I was interested. You all knew the story, right?
Yeah.
The guy that had this rock
with
fall on his arm and then cut his own arm off. And it's a true story. That's why we're not giving anything away, unless, of course, you don't know the news. But that happened. And I was wondering how in the world they make a two-hour film out of that.
Seriously,
story.
Me too.
But by the time you got the flashbacks and what he was processing in terms, like the scene where just before he left on this hike, he didn't tell anybody where he was going,
including,
which is an absolute. Yes. You never do that if you're an outdoor hiker. If you're an indoor hiker, we're not quite so worried. I'm in the living room now, on the couch.
Leave
and
me a
large
note.
Pillow has fallen on me, but I think I can extract it. But if you're an outdoor hiker, you want to tell people where you're going. And his mother has called, and the phone is ringing, and he doesn't answer her. He's too busy getting ready for the hike. And so now he's out there with this boulder trapping him, thinking, Mom, I wish I would have answered the phone, because I would have told you where I'm going, and you would have known where I am. And that kind of real sense of, or the relationships he's had with women, or all the situations where he's chosen to go his own way, and then realizes in reflection that those were not great choices.
And you can.
And now he is alone, and he even says, "I chose this.
Yeah,
right.
I chose this rock. This rock was waiting for me, mm-hmm. and I chose this rock because I wanted to be by myself out here."
Right. And as the mother of a 26-year-old son, which moment do you think made me cry the most? Was it the one, Mom, I promise I'll call you? And I was like.
Oh. So you're like actually wanting to see this be the best picture this year.
I just think for that very reason, who makes a two-hour movie where the entire time somebody's stuck in a canyon with a rock on their arm into such a compelling bit of storytelling? I mean, it's a masterful bit of filmmaking, and the music is amazing. And let's not forget Trent Reznor, the music, because I really do want to pair these. Because the other thing is, the arm goes off. The very first thing he does before he leaves is take a picture.
Yeah.
And so we have that digital, you know, the sort of video narration.
Well, to put it on Facebook, which is another reason why they're the films are related.
Post it.
But both of them.
Will
exactly.
you friend me now?
Both of them are joined by the love of technology in this the young male generation too. This young mm-hmm. the idea that both of them are functioning by sort of self narrating the entire.
You don't want to add anything, Jeff?
Well, there's this great scene where he's filming himself because he realizes he's going to die, and he's like, okay, I'm this son, da, da, da. And he's watching. You know how you can flip the screen part of your video camera wherever you want. So he flips it so he can watch himself talking into the camera. And at some point during the movie, he says, I'm so sick of looking at myself.
Yeah.
And he just turns it over.
Right, mm-hmm. right. It's all, yeah, it's really. reflects it.
Yeah. My main frustration with 127 Hours, why I don't think it's really a best picture, is that it says it's about 127 hours, but the movie is so busy every 30 seconds, yeah. cutting with new pictures and new hallucinations and flashbacks, that it made me feel like Danny Boyle was too uncomfortable with the pain of this situation to really let us be there with Aaron. There's another great movie you could watch alongside this called Touching the Void that's part documentary and part dramatization that gives you the feeling of what it's like to be trapped beneath the earth surrounded by ice, you know, in this ice world for day after day after day, wandering, not thinking you're ever going to get out, and you just feel the toll of that. In this film, I felt the toll of the editing. I don't even know how to assess James Franco's performance because every 5 seconds we get another shot, which is sort of the performance of actor, but also the camera. And I just wanted the feeling of what it's like to be trapped there for a while. I mean, just give me a few minutes to have the sense of the strain on his legs or whatever without just the constant pummeling of new shots. And that bothered me after a while. I felt like Danny Boyle was being impatient, but he's always that way. His movies are always just bang, 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 bang. Mm-hmm. And Darren Aronofsky is the same way, A Bridge to Black Swan, but we'll talk about that later. So.
Okay, we will. Let's move on now to a completely different feel, Toy Story.
We talk
and this,
about
this, by the way, was on
summary
on Rotten Tomato, was the highest film, 99% positive rating. The toys are mistakenly delivered to a daycare center instead of the attic, right before Andy leaves for college, and it's up to Woody to convince the other toys that they weren't abandoned and to return home. And Carlo cried at this movie.
Yes.
As did Jeff. Yeah. This is one of the ones I didn't get to see this year.
It's my favorite movie of the year. We've talked about Pixar so much here, and so I don't want to go on and on about how great they are. But what's unique to me about Toy Story 3, two things. One is I think it's the first time we've had a complete trilogy where there isn't a loser in the bunch. Maybe not a loser, but you could make a good argument about any of the three being the strongest. And they found a way to pick up on things that were at the beginning of the first movie and fulfill them, in the heart of the second movie and fulfill them. And what they did even further was they made Andy, a character with a real story. Andy has a serious choice to make in this film. And the end of the movie really belongs to him. And I thought that was a remarkable step, since it's always been about, you know, Woody and Buzz. But I really think this is, strangely enough, the strongest trilogy American filmmakers have ever made, because it's a complete story, and you can't really fault any of the stories. But if we're talking about theology, there's been some really interesting discussions about how the toys relate to Andy, how we relate to, you know, the maker or the sovereign. Woody is so faithful to, you know, Andy, who owns him and who loves him, and now he has to decide. Well, Andy is kind of putting us away. What do I do? Where are my loyalties now? And he has to have a bigger picture of what his responsibility is. He was made to delight children, and he has to have a bigger picture of what he's for. And I thought that was a really interesting theme for an animated movie that's marketed to kids. And once again, you've got the adults more likely to go see it a second time, I think, than their own children.
But Pixar, maybe more than any single company, has built themes around the great classic storylines and thematic biblical stories, really. You know, Nemo, you just go through the whole list of them. They always have a sense of the redemptive, you know. It's an amazing thing.
And well, the stakes in this film go so high. I mean, they're practically staring into Dante's Inferno at the end of the movie, and I'm going, are you kidding me? We're really going there.
Well, they let it go so long. Yeah. I mean, you know, normally they go, oh, they rest, but oh, my gosh.
It's like the Return of the King.
Do you guys have anything to add on Toy Story 3?
I think that's wonderful. If I were picking five to be, I would top of Toy Story would be in my top five.
Yeah, it's in your top five.
Yeah.
Check it.
He's got the list.
Well, this is Nick Stahl. We're going to be back with some more of the Kindling's Muse at Hales Ales Brewery and Pub. We'll be right back. Don't go away. Well, Well, this is Dick Staub back with you. We're talking about the theology of the Best Picture nominees for the Academy Awards this year. And we continue with a real upbeat film, Black Swan, which at least two different reviewers that I read described as porn.
Whoa.
How many of you saw it? Nasty people. What do you say, Jenny?
We had 14-year-old boys trying to sneak into our showing. It was pretty funny. I thought, really? This is what you want to pick? Just because girls are making out? Like, I don't think you want to sit through this whole thing, buddy. But whatever. They got kicked out.
There's a lot of ballet in
Yeah, there's a lot of ballet, too.
Yeah, that's why 14-year-old boys would go for the ballet.
Right. That was right. Interesting. Read my little two sentences, Dick.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Or can we just say Black Swan is the story of Swan Lake?
Yeah.
But with a psychotic schizophrenic involved.
Yeah.
That's not what they said. A ballet dancer wins the lead in Swan Lake and is perfect for the role of the delicate white swan, Princess Odette, but slowly loses her mind as she becomes more and more like Odette's evil sister, Odile, the Black Swan.
That's good.
Thank you.
Good reading.
So I had mentioned earlier that I thought that the movies this year were kind of interesting takes on a buddy movie, and that two unlikely people are helping each other to achieve the impossible. And I think this movie still is. And it's the two people are Natalie Portman, the White Swan, and Natalie Portman, Black Swan. And they're, for her mind, she does achieve triumph. She achieves perfection in her own mind and in her own sort of twisted sense of reality. Her ultimate goal is that perfection, and she's driven hard by everybody around her. This movie opens with a scene that you're knowing this is a horror film, okay? It starts out with the shaky camera and the kind of scary beginning music of the Swan Lake, and this beast is chasing her around. I mean, it's very much a horror film.
Sounds like Social Network to me.
Exactly.
Same kind of thing.
Very much a horror film, so you know from the first 30 seconds that this is going to be a movie that there's going to be a lot of blood. There's a lot of traditional horror film tactics used in this movie. But what's also interesting is this movie is her entire point of view. It is Nina. It's her point of view. So you don't know whether to trust reality or not because it's her reality. So is her mom really that crazy? You know, is the artistic director really seducing her or not? You don't really know because it's Nina's point of view the whole time. They use a lot of, like Jeff was saying, with jump cuts and extreme close-ups of her face. A lot of mirrors are used to try to get you to enter her world. And at the end of the movie, you got to ask yourself what is reality and what isn't. Theologically, it's another struggle of gracelessness, that there's no grace for this woman. We all can struggle under this delusion that if we just do it right, if we just say our prayers right, if we just, you know, or do this right job, or if we attack that grand jeté correctly, as she has to do, then everything's going to be okay. Everything's going to be wonderful. We are going to be loved. We will be perfect. We will be accepted. But it's the other way around when grace is involved. Grace is the opposite of this. And there's nothing, of course, that we can do to earn God's love. But for Nina and in Nina's world, grace doesn't even exist. It's only perceived perfection that exists. And ultimately, that's what kills her. And that's not a spoiler, because if you know anything about Swan Lake, she has to die. Okay, yeah.
You guys want to add anything?
Well, the problem is that we get all of that pretty much in the first 10 minutes of the movie. I mean, scary movies go, it's borrowing from all kinds of other scary movies that did it better. I mean, even the famous girl-on-girl sex scene now, as a way of portraying this character's own self-love and self-centeredness, was done better in a movie called Mulholland Drive by David Lynch, showing it as a fractured psyche. The problem with Aronofsky is he's so busy just shocking you over and over and over again that he forgets to develop characters. The screenplay reads like an outline. They say the blandest, most obvious things. It's like the audience could have written the screenplay while watching the film, guessing what the next line was going to be.
Right.
The dance sequences are, to some extent, pretty energetic. But it doesn't pull back far enough to let you really marvel at the work.
Well,
that
they can't because it's Natalie Portman, and Natalie Portman is not a professional ballerina, and so they have to do close-ups of feet and make you think that's Natalie Portman. I mean, that's part of the problem.
Isn't one piece of it too sort of the cost of art, the cost of beauty, the cost of perfection that ballet itself sort of always flirts with, that edge of, you know, sacrifice everything, and that somehow the art becomes the god.
Absolutely.
It's the rather than not just not grace, but it's sort of the replacement, that perfection. And so it's that kind of consequences.
Oh, absolutely. And you see that in her mother and the way that her mother, you know, drives. And she even looks at her at one point and says, I give up my dream for you. Basically, I was pregnant with you, and that's what made my dreams go bye-bye, so you better live them out, Chiquita.
But then buys her the huge cake.
Oh yes,
this is the sort of the sabotage as well.
But it's sort of summed up, though. I mean, the last thing you see in the movie, directed by Darren Aronofsky, immediately followed by a film by Darren Aronofsky. Okay, yes, you're very proud of yourself. We get it.
Let's move on to another upbeat movie. The kids are all right.
Yes.
Two children conceived by artificial insemination bring their birth father into their family life.
Yes, I know. I got the easy ones. You notice that I'm the guest panelist, so they're like, "Why don't you talk about that one?"
We got the fun ones. You got the fun ones.
I got the fun ones. Well, I know that the next movie show is going to maybe is taking up the issue of family, so I don't want to talk too much. But I think what we have is we're rooted in love. What do we call love, and what do we call the modern family? So my three ended up being, in a sense, those commentaries on who we are today in a time of a lot of change and a lot of turbulence. I also said this is sort of the yuppie fetish of the perfect family. You know, it really examines under a microscope that idea that so many helicopter parents or, you know, all those things that I am, you know, probably guilty of, is this sort of you can shape perfectly. You can have the prosperous suburb and the perfectly achieving children and, you know, all these ways that I think it really does become every family. So at some level, I'm probably in line with most critics who said that this was a really kind of poignant examination of all families and what do we do. There's complicated origins in a complicated story like that, but there's adoption and single parents. I mean, there's a lot of families that would maybe see a complicated story.
And I understand you and Jeff were having a fight online.
We've been having a discussion. No. I think we're of the same mind, but it's much more.
Then why was it a fight?
It wasn't a fight.
Someone interpreted
Facebook.
It as a fight.
It was Facebook. What do you say?
It's Facebook. Oh,
okay. It's all Facebook.
It's all Mark Zuckerberg's fault.
Well, that's really. Right. Yeah. Right.
Well, where were you coming back to that? Where were you coming from on this?
I thought that the movie was very interesting to watch the children because they're so interested in finding their biological father. That is a missing piece in their life. To me, one of the central moments of the movie is when a child looks at this biological father that is now in the picture and says, "Why couldn't you be better?" I thought that was frankly addressed to all the parents, really, in general, in the film, because they've let them down in so many ways. And ultimately, it becomes a film about not what your family structure is, but about is there love in it? And they have all failed each other in so many ways that it's just a very broken-hearted movie.
Except for, but see, this is our disagreement. Slight. Because
it's not a fight, but it's a disagreement.
Well, the thing is, all families are broken. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know what? I said that to my father.
Yeah,
why can't you be better? And so what I guess
what did he say? No, I'm sorry.
We don't go there.
I'm just a father. I'd like to get a good answer for that question.
Yeah, because see, I didn't come away with the brokenness. I came away with what, that's so real. We all, marriages struggle, marriages get stale, partners cheat. Siblings are close and then they're also frustrated with each other. And what I came away with was really love. That in the end, so it wasn't heartbreaking to me. It was so real. It was real about how it's really hard to love in the face of that kind of the reality of our human.
Don't you
brokenness.
Feel for the father at the end, though? I mean, he's
not at all.
He's cut off now.
Are you kidding?
Really?
He's screwing around with the waitresses. He's an immature, self-absorbed.
The consequences of his actions, absolutely.
But it's not a fight.
No. see,
it's
this
semantics.
Is why. And I told you I loved the Annette Bening moment where she said, "This is my family."
Yeah. Absolutely.
And that's, you know, much more.
But she's
what
shown
that was
responsibility
about.
For it. So she's earned that.
And they raise those kids.
So are we supposed
Joni.
To feel hopeful that all families are messed up?
No.
I mean, that's what it sounds like.
Hopeful
the thematic.
That messed up.
We're supposed to feel hopeful that we're all in the same boat.
And that
is that the hopeful note? of the film?
Jeff wasn't hopeful.
I wasn't terribly hopeful.
I think the hopeful note is that we're all messed up, but your family, hopefully, is based on love. And that the bond of love that you have for each other in your family, in this hard scrabble world that we have together, we can look at one another and say, all right, you're mine.
You can,
and that love is going to undergird the worst of what you're going to go through, for better or worse.
Unfortunately, like where a lot of movies fail is it sums this up with a speech. And I just can't stand movies that end with a speech about what it's about. If it's a speech like, will he deliver the speech without stammering, that's
yes,
one
okay.
thing. But if you're going to sum it up for us. So,
Okay, now we move on to a film that made complete sense and was completely clear in its plotline development.
Oh, no.
Inception. In a world where technology exists to enter the human mind through dream invasion, a highly skilled thief is given a final chance at redemption, which involves executing his toughest job to date, Inception. Jenny, take it away.
So Inception, just in general, the definition of Inception is implanting an idea so deep within someone else's subconscious that they think it was their own idea. And they kind of explain it in the movie where Leonardo DiCaprio says, okay, think about pink elephants. That's not Inception. That was my idea telling you to think about pink elephants. He said, you have to get so deep inside someone's brain, and in this movie, in their dreams, to be able for them to think they thought of it themselves. So that's what Leonardo DiCaprio's character, Cobb, is trying to do. But ultimately, it's about his unresolved dream world and his unresolved reality and unreality. Again, this is kind of a, we could have dovetailed, pardon the pun, with Black Swan.
Shutter Island, where it's Leo DiCaprio again.
Yes,
in his
which
own
I actually thought was a little bit of a better film.
I agree.
But this is another film about what is reality and what is not, and how does what is unreal affect what is real. There's an interesting parallel in this movie, too, I think, that they're taking it into what is heaven and what is hell, and do we create our own hells, here on Earth or not. There's kind of this sort of trite idea out there in the world about how life after death. And there's this idea that if you carry the memory of that person in your heart, that person's still alive, you know. But tell that to Leonardo DiCaprio's dead wife, you know. But no, she's not. But she is alive so deeply in his subconscious that these memories are controlling him. And he has to make that stop. So he's created his own hell and put his wife there.
Nolan did Memento too,
yes.
Didn't he?
Yes, yeah. And the whole Batman series. I mean, Christopher Nolan, I really enjoy his work.
The
he's
Prestige.
Pretty brilliant. Yeah. He's very brilliant.
But don't we have like Philip K. Dick resurrected here? I mean, isn't this the endless Philip K. Dick recycling these stories? I mean, they're like 1950s sci-fi, like Minority Report, you know, all this.
Is this a film that wouldn't have made the top five if there were only five nominees?
Oh, yeah.
Definitely. It was a surprise to some people that made the top 10.
Yeah.
I might have put it in the top five just because of the concept of it and because of Nolan's previous work, as well as just how it was visually on the screen and how they constructed this strange dream world, I think hit people at such a, that is what it's like. So I think that it could garner some critical acclaim just because of that.
It needed to be a miniseries, though. I mean, instead of calling it Inception, I would have called it Explanation, because all of the characters are just constantly explaining things to each other, and we never get a sense of real character or personality from any of them.
Plus, I always remember, Jeff, you said that there wouldn't be any romance between Ellen Page and Leonardo DiCaprio because they let their height difference be really obvious on the screen. I always remember you called that one.
From the
trailer. You said, there's no romance because look at
she's
the height
so much
difference.
Shorter than him. Yeah. They can never do that in a Hollywood movie.
And he was right.
Wow. Okay. let's move on to The Fighter. A look at the early years of boxer Irish Mickey Ward and his brother who helped train him before going pro in the mid-1980s. Another true story, based on another true story.
It's tough.
And how many of you out there saw The Fighter? Okay.
Okay. It's tough to make a boxing movie at this point that seems original or engaging because there have been so many of them. And you know how they're all going to end. And you pretty much knew how this one was going to end. But I got to hand it to David O. Russell. I mean, I couldn't take my eyes off it. It's a very engaging film. The actors are all incredible. Mark Wahlberg trained for 4 years, looked like a boxer. It was very convincing. And yet, another thing I really love about Wahlberg's performance is he really steps back, plays a sort of soft-spoken character, and lets these animals, these monster characters sort of take over.
Yeah.
And if Christian Bale wins, I mean, well, no surprise there.
Seriously.
He's incredible as the half-brother. But at the heart of the story, you have all these different interests in Mickey's life. His mother wants to manage him, his brother wants to manage him, his manager wants to manage him, go figure. And they all disagree. So it really becomes a movie, I think, you know, in a way, strangely political, about are you willing to reach across the table and agree with someone on the other side in order for the greater good to take place, which is to get Mickey to that championship and have him win. And the scene in the movie that has just a loud heartbeat is when one character is willing to compromise and put down what he wants in order to help everybody get along. Mm-hmm. So Mickey won't lose the fight because he's so worried about the other fight going on between his family members and his friends. Having said that, personally, I have a real difficulty with the sport of boxing because the goal is to at least somewhat incapacitate your opponent. And 90% of boxers end their careers with serious permanent brain damage.
Yeah.
And what if this had been a film about dogfighting?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Would we have been just cheering at the end when the right dog won? Or would we still have been going, wasn't there a better thing to hope for? At the end of the film, I didn't want Mickey to win the fight. I wanted the whole family to wake up and realize this culture they're living in that's so poisoned with violence and greed, really. I mean, they want to win and that there's really nothing beyond that. So that glimmer...
You hoped that they would all become ballet dancers.
Well, I knew... No.
I would have made it worse.
It's a true story, so what are they going to do, right? Yeah. They're not going to change that. But it was hard for me to
Christian
share.
Bale was unbelievable.
He was.
I mean, the performance was just unreal.
Yeah.
And then at the end of the movie, when you saw the characters on which it is based,
yes.
They're really like
those
characters.
Well, and Mickey and his opponent went into trauma care after that final fight in real life, and there's no mention of that.
You know, I know what you're saying about the boxing subculture, but you know, for a town like that in Massachusetts, that is that subculture's hope of getting some notoriety and being known and. You know, and so it's what they know.
Yeah.
It's what they know, and it's what they do, and yeah.
I think football, though, is equally guilty if you're going to take up the question.
Yeah. Head
not
trauma.
Just dog. You know.
Let's do a whole show on that.
Yeah, let's
Rudy,
do that.
Rudy, I mean, but think of how much you know in America, the culture of football as you know, sort of the synonym for American success. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Same problem.
Okay. How many football fans out there?
Exactly.
Just
saying.
That's
right.
I'm just saying.
Just want the podcast listeners to know there is a slight protest. It's kind of bubbling up like in Egypt. Who knows what's going to happen next? Wow. Okay, we've moved quickly through this. We've got Winter's Bone left.
What a great film.
An unflinching Ozark Mountain girl hacks through dangerous social terrain as she hunts down her drug-dealing father while trying to keep her family intact.
Interesting contrast with Two Grit, because you've got a 13-year-old girl trying to avenge the death of her father. Here you've got a 17-year-old girl whose father has really betrayed the family and who's now put them in a situation where they're going to lose the house. And you don't want to lose this house, because this house is in the middle of a woods surrounded by meth cookers.
Yeah.
And those happen to be the only people she can go to for help. She's raising her two younger siblings, technically, because her mother is sort of a mental case at this point, and it's easy to see why when you see what kind of community this is. So Jennifer Lawrence, I frankly would give the Oscar to Jennifer Lawrence because she created a three-dimensional human being. You talk about 3D this year. This character, Ree Dolly, was in 3D. I was with her every step of the way as she puts her life on the line again and again and again for the safety of her siblings, for their future as a family, trying to save the family. But it's also complicated and completely unpredictable in a way that no other film I saw this year was. You did not know what was going to happen scene to scene. Part of that is because the characters are so well developed. Her uncle, played by John Hawkes, Teardrop, when you meet him, you think he is to be feared in this community, and he is. He's horrible. He abuses his wife. He's reckless, and he's hooked on meth. But if you stay with him long enough, there is a thread of decency in him that becomes sort of the one thread Ree Dolly has to hold on to survive this. Ultimately, there is grace, but it comes with a, it is hard to find. And at the end, you know that they are still in almost as much danger as they have ever been in. But there is a hymn, again, another parallel with True Grit, a hymn at the heart of this film. Farther along, we'll know all about it. Farther along, we'll understand why. Cheer up, my brother. Live in the sunshine. We'll understand it all by and by. That's a beautiful hymn, but also very melancholy because it puts all of our hope somewhere else.
An addiction as well, which a connection with the fighter.
Yes.
I mean, the idea of the sort of costs and consequences of that.
And a connection with that director's previous film, which is called Close to the Bone, about a character who's addicted to drugs. And so you get the feeling this is a very personal vision for her.
Before we take a quick break, and then we'll get to the audience's questions and comments, and I know a lot of you have seen a lot of these movies and you've got questions or comments that you'd like to make, and we'll get to as many of them as we can. Is there a thematic connection between most of these films? I mean, if you go and see these 10 films, you drop in from another planet, and you say, what's happening on Earth these days? And you want to know what the zeitgeist of the planet is. What jumps out at you as what these films are telling us as a mirror about our culture?
Well, I've said that I feel like these are these movies are about two unlikely people helping each other achieve the impossible. And if you think about when they were made, okay, so they came out this year, but they were made basically in 2008, 2009. So what was happening in our culture at that point? We were having new elections. There was a lot of hope and change things out there. And I think that these movies are reflecting that it's no longer No Country for Old Men, like everything is vanity and let's just all die. It's a turn to this, no, if I can turn to my brother, my sister, my friend, my family, together we can surmount this. And frankly, what's going on in half of the world right now are people banding together out of love and hope for their fellow human being. So that's what I see.
So not you in saw every the buddy movie thing happening all over
yeah,
the
not
place.
In every single one of them, but in almost all of them, you can kind of pull that out.
Okay, how about you, Chris?
And I was going to say, I vote for the real. I vote for, we moved away from fantasy, even No Country for Old Men, where you have this sort of quasi-comic book, you have, you know, fantasy, imaginative, really hero, villain, Batman, whatever. I think we've moved to the real world, and maybe that's the other piece of 2008-9, meaning the recession, the crash, the idea of we've got to survive, and how do we do that? How do we be connected, surrender, love, trust, hope?
For me, it's about characters discovering that their real ambitions were misguided, or maybe if they don't, they pay the consequences. So, you know, Matty Ross wants vengeance, so Mark Zuckerberg wants to succeed with this
vengeance idea.
Nina in Black Swan wants to be the star, and she pays the price for it. I think it, you know, if you boiled them all down to one theme, you could use this scripture, and I'm paraphrasing a bit. If I speak in HTML, but have not love, I am only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of social networking, master Facebook's privacy settings, and accept 5,000 friend requests, but have not love, I am nothing. And but you could translate that for any of these films. Toy Story 3 again. A community is holding on to each other, even as they descend, seemingly without hope, into the fire, and grace breaks through in a rather strange and unlikely way, but we'll leave it at that.
Interesting. Well, I'm going to... Oh, first of all, before we take the break, everybody has to choose your best picture.
Ah. And I... Okay,
from these
so
10, or...?
From these 10.
Well, I always say the King's Speech is going to win... But I would have voted for 127 hours.
I want The King's Speech to win, but I don't think it will. I think Social Network will, because I think it's the new versus old debate that's going on right now.
You know what I want to win, but I think it's a horse race between The King's Speech and Social Network. Yeah.
But you want
Toy Story 3.
And which picture that's
it's
not
about
in the
time
top 10?
It's about time an animated film won Best Picture, unless you count The Return of the King. But
okay, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. This is Dick Stahl. We're going to be back with our audience's comments about the 10 Best Picture nominees in the Academy Awards. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
to Dick Stoppback with you. We've had another spirited conversation about the 10 Best Picture nominees for the Academy Award, and we've been trying quickly to move through them and talk about the themes and what they're telling us about ourselves and our beliefs, our world, our culture, and therefore the theology of some of these best pictures. And we have two people who asked the identical question.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Is that a first?
So I'm going to introduce them in a moment, and it's going to be some sort of weird movie. Heather,
Swan,
what's your question?
Which film or films do you think was overlooked in the nomination?
Oh, thank you for...
Paul, your question.
What movie wasn't mentioned that should have been?
Thank you. I'd like you two to meet each other. We have a lovely parting gift for the two of you tonight. All right. So what should have been in the... I mean, it's getting ridiculous with 10 nominees.
I know. That's hard.
Yeah, it's kind of you know... But what would you have liked to have seen in there?
You better go, because I'm
there was no crying camel this year, Jeff, so we know it's not that.
Yeah, that was a while ago.
I know, but I'll never forget it.
It opened really late here, and I have a feeling that's why it wasn't nominated. I have a feeling a lot of the Academy members didn't see it in time, but it's called Another Year, directed by Mike Lee. We often hear the complaint, why don't we ever see portrayals of marriages in film that aren't about a crumbling, horrible, miserable marriage? Another Year with Jim Broadbent and Leslie Manville and some other incredible British actors gives us one of the most beautiful portrayals of a marriage I've ever seen in a film. And it's this couple that just reaches out in grace to the ruined people around them, the alcoholics and the hopeless and the ones that can't get their driver's licenses. Their home becomes like this refuge for these people, and they just give grace upon grace upon grace, even when they show these people show up on their doorstep in the middle of like an important family meeting. It's just all about that kind of patience. There was also a very brave and hilarious satire called Four Lions that only played here briefly. That's actually a satire, a comedy about wannabe Al-Qaeda terrorists. Four guys who want to join Al-Qaeda, and they're going to make the best fake terrorist video, you know, with the gun and the threats they can to win an audition sort of for Al-Qaeda. And it's like watching Monty Python at their best. I couldn't stop laughing. It's great. So
you're under surveillance now. You do know that.
Oh, and they think they are. So whenever they go out in public, they go around like this in case there's a camera on them and they'll be blurry.
Well, I was wondering why you were doing that.
Case in point. No,
I know.
Now don't tell me.
Okay. That works.
You guys have anything?
All I have is the only other movie besides these my husband dragged me to, and it's horrible. It's called The Tourist. So I would never have nominated that, but it was a Golden Globe nominee. So I'll just say I wouldn't have, but the Foreign Press, Hollywood Foreign Press did, and my husband, and I just won't even mention the Angelina Jolie fetish that was behind that. But okay.
Well, that was the theory.
That's my anti-nominee.
That was the theory about why it was nominated. It was so the Hollywood Foreign Press could all hang out with Johnny Depp and Angelina Jolie.
Seriously. And what movie makes Johnny Depp look sort of fat, frumpy, boring, old? It was appalling. Sorry. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let it
I
all out.
I get this question every year, and I always I never prepare for it. You think
Lauren,
after now.
What's your question?
Can we further explore the theology of Toy Story 3? The movie is the story of Woody discovering his loyalty to Andy is secondary or misplaced to his ultimate teleological purpose. Is there anything we should take from this choice that he makes, if not as a direct analogy, at least as a lesson for us?
Jeff?
I always close the show talking about Pixar, and I'm agreeing
about teleological purposes, too.
That's an honor student.
I think if we work too hard to make Andy like a god figure in this series, we're in trouble. I mean, he's a kid, and these are toys. And to Pixar's credit, they take that so seriously that the toys have to ultimately figure out how to be good toys. You could, I suppose, stretch it to say that we have to keep expanding our understanding of God or something. You could say that the definition of who they need to be serving keeps expanding. I don't know. Say more if that's not getting to what you're...
Well,
excuse me just a moment.
Hang on, she's not
Mike. Carlo's having a coronary.
Oh, right. Podcast, I forget.
Here we go. Honor student.
Well, it's just that it seemed like that it was really important that in the end Woody figured out what he was supposed to be doing with his life, you know, which was to fulfill his purpose as a toy, and which was contrary to his view the entire time that he was supposed to be like fulfilling his loyalty to Andy. And that just seemed significant to me that his for purpose as a toy was different than what he perceived to be an honorable goal or loyalty. And I just didn't know how to like apply that to myself as a human.
Can I kind of step in there and win points with my boss at the same time? Let's see if I can do that. Read Dick Staub's work. He does a lot of good. He actually has some good things to say about what it means to be what you were made to be and what it means to be fully human and finding our true purpose in who we are in God. And I think Dick, more than any of us on this panel,
and like I'm
does an excellent
boss.
Job of saying that. I know. So maybe take it with a grain of salt. But really, the ideas that Dick talks about and that we try to talk about on the show is finding exactly that. What is our unique purpose in Christ, but also what is our
Becoming who God made you to be is the way you please your maker. Is the kind of the short version of the, you know, am I supposed to be a toy or am I supposed to be loyal, you know, to my maker? Is there kind of two sides of one coin, I think, is what Jenny said.
And it's kind of ironic that in the end, Andy is changing his mind about what the toys should be doing. So Woody is being loyal to Andy by making that shift. Even though it hurts.
Does anybody here think that we've all lost our minds to expect deep meaning out of films? I mean, are all these filmmakers saying, I don't know, like, let's, you know, what, you know, because there's no question when you go to Sundance Film Festival and you see films there, many of the films are obviously somebody's passionate to make a point, and they don't care whether they would like it to be successful economically, but it's a lot more about telling the story that matters to them. Whereas Hollywood, right out the chute, you know that they're trying to make money on this. Now, they have a story to tell, too. But what is the purpose of film in 21st century life? I mean, are we overdoing it with the idea that there's a theology in these stories?
No.
Okay, explain why.
Well, partly just because I teach narrative theory, and, you know, that's right up my whole world, is humans process the creation through story. We always have. Christ taught through story. We wrote, you know, we used to tell them orally around the campfire, then we wrote them. And really now, this I strongly believe, our cultural stories are films. People really don't read shared novels except for, you know, the Harry Potter or the Twilight, the occasional. And even then, did I ever read Twilight? No. I really strongly believe that story is what matters. It's how we tell our deepest truths to each other. And I think film, I don't think we're overreading film, because this is how we share meaning in this world today. And that's global, right?
You know how we've just learned that Bing is stealing search results from Google? I mean, did you hear that news? That's their big secret, and why they're better than Google is they're stealing results from Google? Frederick Buechner meant when he said that the world speaks of the holy in the only language it knows, which is a worldly language. When we are expressing the eternity in our hearts and we don't know Christ, we don't know God's vision for his creation, we end up going to the gospel anyway. You look at any of these stories and what's meaningful about them, what's beautiful about them, echoes, reflects the gospel. Stealing results, sort of, but really that's where it all goes back to, is God's purpose for his creation. So,
Sky, what's your question?
Well, looking into the crystal ball, but also looking backwards into history, what movie should be made now so that in 2 years we will appreciate it?
Wow.
Jenny?
Thanks. Because I brought that up, huh? I suppose it shows my somebody will probably make a Tea Party movie.
That's what I was thinking.
It probably shows my bias that I would love to see. I'm trying to even think of a director who might be fun to watch. Well, I love Danny Boyle, so of course I would love to see him do anything. But to make a movie about what's going on right now in the Middle East, I think that is a I personally feel like this is a time that our children, our grandchildren will say, oh, you were alive then. What was that like? What was it going on? You know, so I would love to see someone do, especially in Egypt, what happened in Egypt, I mean, was almost like a movie script. I mean, the fact that for the most part, it was peaceful. For the most part, these people came together with one voice and they triumphed. I mean, I thought, I don't know about the rest of you, but I thought that man was going to kill all those people when he said he wasn't going to step down. And yet, I mean, it felt like a movie script playing out. And then waking up the next morning here and seeing that he was gone and these people had triumphed was gorgeous. Now, what's going to happen from that? I don't know. We're in the middle of it. And so that would be an interesting, I think, film in a couple of years.
And you do have Wael Gonim. I don't know if any of you saw the interview with him on 60 Minutes, the figure, the Google executive who was sort of behind. You could see the charisma of someone like him. But also, did you hear him say after the 12 days in prison with the blindfold and he'd been beaten, the first thing he did was go up to all the guards and tell them that he forgave them and hugged them and kissed
and
them.
Yeah.
He said they didn't know. They were told I was a traitor. They were doing...
But
and
he
I
also
thought,
said...
No wonder they won.
He also said he's disinterested in being a leader. So this is kind of a headless revolution throughout the Middle East right now.
But I didn't mean to
Facebook
get into
generation,
like, Middle East politics.
I mean, it's Wiki. It's Deleuze and Guattari, the postmodern theorists, you know, where it's the plateau, it's the rhizome.
So it will actually be interesting, but probably more in like 3 or 4 or 5 years because it's going to take the world time to digest this, what movies are coming out at that point.
Yeah.
I'd like to see a film made from a book by a young adult author named Sarah Zarr. She writes stories about high school kids in which the plot is not about finding self-worth by getting the attention of the guy you're interested in. I'm not going to talk about Twilight, but the idea that there's more to live for than finding true love by the time you graduate from high school. She writes these raw stories about what kids are really going through in their families and in high school. Story of a Girl, Sweethearts, Once Was Lost, 3 fantastic novels. The first one was a National Book Award finalist. They're in the young adult section, and they're some of the best novels I've read in the last few years. So I'd love to see one of those become a movie, and there's a chance that might actually happen. So.
Mark, your question.
You want me to read both of them?
Go ahead.
Two questions. What are your favorite Oscar winners, best pictures of all times? All time. And the second one is, in Inception, does the top stop spinning at the end?
Spoiler alert.
I think it does stop. I think it's one of the last shots of it falling over on the table when he's out in the yard. I think it's on the corner of the table and just goes.
There's a whole theory though that the top was actually his wife's totem. He has a wedding ring in some scenes and mysteriously not in others. And so there's a whole theory that that's actually his totem, and that's how you tell, because whether or not he's wearing that at the end. But that's a whole other subject. Anyway, was there another question?
Best picture
of all time.
That's hard. I think I can. I have a quick answer. It's just there's so many. You know, it's like picking your favorite child. There's so many. But the year. There's so many. I have so many.
There's
children.
There's so many children.
So many. I have so many favorite children. But. But I do remember the year where I went, that film so utterly captures the world. And you know, usually the one I pick the one that will win and the one that should win, you know, like District 9 should have won. And that was the year that I went, that's the film. And for me, it was American Beauty.
Oh, I was afraid you were going to say that.
I know. I knew he was afraid I was going to say that. But just not that we, you know, there was so much.
Now we can
not
fight.
Problems. Not that there's not problems. But... a couple of things. I think it caught a sort of American suburban affluence bubble, tech bubble, prosperity, and it was 1999. And then Alan Ball. I heard a theologian at Fuller talk about the scene about, you know, there's something more, the plastic bag and beauty as standing for it. It pointed towards something more. I think even Alan Ball and Sam Mendes didn't even really realize what they were. The more they were pointing to. But more just, I just thought, for once, a really great, thought-provoking, interesting, super awesome film won, rather than like Titanic or, you know, something that sort of is just popular. So that would be one, at least for me.
Jenny?
Casablanca.
Really?
Really? Come on.
Yeah.
Come on. Casablanca? You're asking me, really? I mean, that movie still holds up. It's not, I mean, you watch it and you're still gripped by that story. The script is amazing. The shooting is gorgeous. It's still an incredible film after years and years and years and years.
I got to say, I'm having a hard time coming up with it, partly because, and this is the mystery of the Oscars year after year after year, is we put so much attention into this, but in the end, they have so little credibility that I've forgotten 3 months into it who won what. What really matters is which of these movies are we still watching in 20 years and going, wow, I'm still finding new stuff in it. So as far as that goes, I got to agree with Jenny. That's a great pick.
That is a good pick.
Yeah. Okay. Final comments from anybody. Anything that you'd like to add in conclusion tonight?
Well, I think I said, I'll briefly just say the whole thing about story and not apologizing for film and loving film and participating in film going and conversation about it. It's our stories.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I would say that even the Hollywood filmmakers actually do have something to say and actually do care about their craft, especially the ones that are looked at for the Oscars and some of these critical awards. But they care about it too, and it's worth our time to see the ones that interest us.
I think the culture's response to what's opening every Friday can change if we rediscover what we've left behind in American culture, in American movie-going culture, which is the post-viewing conversation. We finish a movie, and it's like we've eaten a box of Oreos or something. We're done. We feel good for a while. We wake up in the morning. We probably regret we went to the movie, if we even remember what we saw. But if you go out afterwards, you can redeem even 2 wasted hours on a bad movie by talking about why it was bad and thinking about artistic choices like that, or thinking about these questions, what it shows about the worldview of the filmmaker. I'd also want to recommend some films that are coming up. The Tree of Life from Terrence Malick looks absolutely, the trailer is better than most movies I've seen. Martin Scorsese is now looking at, after he gets done with his family Christmas movie for next year, he's doing Endo's novel Silence with Daniel Day-Lewis and a variety of other first-class actors. So that's going to be a theological conversation for the whole country.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, when I didn't respond to the question about the theme this year, and I don't have time to get into why this is my sense of the theme this year, but my theme would be that the planet is weeping. There's a lot of sadness. There's a lot of sorrow. There's a lot of conflict. And there's not a lot of resolution beyond simply we're in this together, we love each other. But there's not a lot of real hopefulness beyond that. And I think, agreeing with your point about story, I think it's saying something about where we are in our understanding of the human story. We have a lot more questions than answers at this point, and that raises some important questions for how our faith responds to that. I'm going to end with Frederick Buechner tonight on this idea of the planet is weeping. Whenever you find tears in your eyes, especially unexpected tears, it is well to pay the closest attention. They are not only telling you something about the secret of who you are, but more often than not, God is speaking to you through them of the mystery of where you have come from and is summoning you to where, if your soul is to be saved, you should go to next. Think about the films that touch you and realize that it's touching something in your story, and be attentive to it. This is Dick Staub. Thanks a lot for joining us tonight on the Kindling's Muse. We'll look forward to seeing you next time around.